And we are on with Jackie Walker. Welcome. Thank you for your time. I'm very, very excited to have you on again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm saying again because I have to admit I did a big mistake. We had a beautiful and lovely conversation last Friday, but I didn't press the recording button. So that's where we're at. So much happening in UK at the moment. And Jackie Walker, you're a British political activist, writer, educator, and an anti-racist voice of reason and courage that has I have been following you since 2016. And my first question is, how do we become a leading activist such as yourself in the UK empire? I mean, you scared the establishment and the Zionists so much.
I know.
They had to put you on their list and they threw everything they had against you. So more than ever, I think it's very important to create space for the people like you. And the audience, the new audience that I have, I was hoping would be very interested about what you're doing. So who are you, Jackie Walker? Can you lead us a little bit?
Yeah, in English football, we have a chant that goes, "Who the bloody hell are you?" I don't know if you know it, but I have had that kind of thing said to me, and not just from people on the right, from people on the left as well, because I'm not standard issue. I don't come from this long tradition of left-wing groups. I'm a sort of maverick player on the scene. And I think in a way, as effective that I am, that's what makes me effective. It makes people listen to me in a different way because, you know, on the left as well as on the right, there's a tendency to sort of regurgitate the same formulas in the same way. So, I mean, I was born in America. I'm Jewish and black. I then lived in Jamaica as a child, came over to the UK in 1959. And we lived both in Jamaica and in the UK in what can only be described as abject poverty. However, my mother was an extremely well-educated and political person. She had been an activist in the civil rights movement in the US. In fact, that's why she was deported from America for un-American activities. And that's where she met my father, who was a Russian Ashkenazi Jew. She was a black Caribbean woman who had got a scholarship to go to Howard University to become a doctor. So this is a really unusual relationship. So on one side, you have somebody from, I suspect, was a very kind of a formal communist background. Remembering my father would have been born at the turn of the 20th century. So he was very close to that exposition of communist theory. Whereas my mother's political, if you like, ideology was developed from a long history of resistance to slavery and resistance to racism. And the civil rights movement. So I think something I often say is I'm somebody who was sort of almost born an activist. As I said, my mother was deported.
Yeah.
We were deported along with her. And one of my early memories, even in the UK, is going to a demonstration when we were children. But I didn't join really any of the left-wing groups. I did stand as a local councillor for the Labour Party many, many years ago, but left because of the Iraq War and because of Tony Blair becoming Prime Minister, because I could see exactly where it was going. And then I became active in community politics, anti-racist politics, where I was working on a sort of national and international level. In fact, I actually went to Switzerland doing anti-racism in Switzerland. That's what brought me to Zurich, in fact. It was probably about 5 or so years before Jeremy Corbyn became the leader of the British Labour Party that I rejoined Labour. And yeah, but I'd kind of known Corbyn for some time before then because I'd also worked, this is another thing I'd done. I'd worked for an organization called the Southwest African People's Organization, which was allied to the ANC. It used to be called a terrorist organization. We need to remember that when we're
Yes,
thinking
indeed.
about Palestine. And we worked with the PLO, with the IRA. We kind of met with them, coordinated things with them. And so I kind of, I gathered my political knowledge through seeing what worked on the ground. And then when I was quite old, really, say 45 or so, I went back to university and I did some postgraduate work, theoretical studies. So I've had a kind of, it's not, what I'm saying is, it's not an orthodox entry. And as a black woman, I'm not the standard issue British leftist spokesperson either.
Yeah. Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader of the Labour Party in 2016, if I'm not mistaken. And that's when I came about your work, and I started to be very interested because I felt like that was the closest we were for a long time to get some real change, because I've been following Jeremy Corbyn, and I'm quite able to say who is honest in their work and authentic, and also because he was very much like fighting forever, like for 40 years he was on picket lines, and he was also shrugging joining the struggle against anti-racism, against the apartheid, and against everything. So I was really much excited about what could happen if he was to be the prime minister. And obviously, I very quickly witness a disaster, I would say. And you're gonna lead us on to what happened, really. But when I saw that he was backtracking, apologizing for the mural or for other reason, also throwing the forefront allies such as yourself under the bus for false reason, to be honest, always the same, like anti-Semitism critiques, and that was sticking. Actually, that was working. Then I was like, well, this is not going to lead very, very far. And unfortunately, I also could see the Labour Party was fiercely fighting him more than even the right. So that was obvious, but that was very interesting at this moment. And maybe you can tell us more about what really happened in 2016, also through this organization called what was it called? The
Momentum.
Momentum, indeed. Where you joined, then yeah.
So, I mean, I would say that what was happening in the Labour Party was actually a political civil war. So, I will start about, I will go, I'll backtrack and talk about how that happened because,
Yes.
I remember Jeremy coming to my house the Christmas before he was elected as Labour leader. And none of us would have thought or imagined that that was going to happen. And this is very important because of the political moment we are in now, certainly in the UK. I have no idea what's happening where you are. But we're at a political moment where the bi-party system is fracturing. And
Yes,
there
indeed.
is an opportunity opening for another upsurge in radical left politics in an effective way. And what I'm saying is, there is something, isn't there, about the travel of the dialectics of politics where you can't force it, you can't construct it, but you can see when it's happening and you can try and attempt to organize for it. And I think that's the point we're at this point, and it was the point we were at that time. But even literally 2 months before that, you wouldn't have guessed that that was going to happen.
We were
totally unaware. And we knew something was happening as soon as we started to canvas for Jeremy Corbyn to be. And, you know, the reason why Jeremy Corbyn stood as candidate was that all the other left leaders, parliamentary leaders, had already had a go at it and had failed. And it was his turn. Nobody particularly wanted to do it. It was a lot of work. You know, you get a lot thrown at you, but it was his turn. So I'm talking, if you like, about the accidental nature that had Jeremy as the leader. Now, Jeremy is all sorts of things. He's a very nice person. He's a very honest person.
Principled.
Very principled. He believes everything that he says. There is, you know, he is exactly what you see. But what he is, and I've said this many times, he is the closest thing to a vicar that we have ever had in Westminster. And what we needed and what we still need on the left now are fighters. Because whenever the left gets into a position with the potential to have any real power, the establishment, all of it, that means the media, it means the political class, it means the bureaucracy, it means the secret services, it means the army, it means everything, everyone will throw everything against you. Now, I say that because I don't know if you know, but, you know, for example, there was one point where it was reported a general of the army saying, of the British army, I'm talking about.
I remember,
about,
yeah.
That if Jeremy Corbyn was voted in as prime minister, there would be the army on the streets. So I'm not exaggerating when I say any of these things. And we also, I'm absolutely as sure as I am that there was Mossad involvement, that there was definitely MI5 involvement in everything that was going on. Anyway, long story short, he was elected. Problem in a way at that point was he was elected at a time where the left didn't really, I think we were naive. Yeah. I think we were naive. We actually had some kind of idea that the right of the party would accept the democratic election, the choice that had been made. We had no idea what was going to hit us. I mean, thankfully, this time, I think we have every idea.
Yes.
We have every idea what will hit us. And it kind of happened pretty much straight away. So you already had a problem. So you had the left holding the roles of the executive as a shadow cabinet. So they weren't in government. They were in what we call the shadow cabinet, with the leader and a shadow home secretary and a shadow chancellor, for example. But you had the MPs in parliament who already had decided they were going to do whatever they could to undermine and destroy this. So that's the setup that you've got. Now, I'm saying this, and a lot of people will be saying, oh, yeah, well, maybe. But actually, I can't show you the proof, but just do a bit of research. You will see there's evidence for this. I am not just telling a story.
Yeah, but there were these documentaries, The Lobby, who kind of proved your points, notably on Mossad involvement or Zionist lobbying, at least.
Yes. So all that was so. So at the beginning, what happened was all the left-wing groups, and I went as a representative of one of the major left-wing groupings, we got together. This was before the election of Jeremy as leader. And we organized what the campaign was going to be. We ran a very, in my local area, we ran a very successful campaign. That campaign, actually, interestingly, because I think that's relevant to what I might say later, the campaign that we ran for the selection of Jeremy came out of the campaign, which was very effective, which we ran to keep Nigel Farage out of Parliament. Nigel Farage is our key right-wing player, who the Labour Party by default have just allowed to get into Parliament, by the way. So what I'm saying is one campaign builds upon another, just like this new campaign will now build on what we've already laid the foundations for. Anyway, what was promised was that at the end of the campaign, this very valuable database, because of course a database is an extremely powerful and tool for political campaigning, would be shared between the left groupings. What actually happened, and it happened under the umbrella of this new organization, which was called Momentum, was that one person got hold of that database and it was made the property of a private company that was enshrined within Momentum. Now, none of us who worked with Momentum knew that at the time. I'm speaking about what we then found out. Anyway, I had the lucky chance of being a black woman. And I'm saying that because you know what happens? It's so, so tiring in left-wing politics. I'm sure it also happens in right-wing politics, but it happens in a different way. And you become the token, whatever. And I was selected as the vice chair as the token black woman, because they looked at me and they didn't realize I had a political brain inside me, or that I would in any way want to act with some independence from the way they wanted me to act. Mm. I say they because Momentum at that point was really in the control of the chair called John Landsman, who has now really, it's kind of obvious that he's what you would call a liberal Zionist, by the way. He was a very rich, independently rich, on the left for many years, but independently rich, and he became the chair of Momentum. And that really set the stage for much of what happened.
Who elected him, though, at this position of chair of Momentum? Did he like hire himself, or is it like a process or a fake process?
I think the whole thing was a fake process, including my election, because actually what happened was John Landsman took me in a room when the election was going on, and the election process was not transparent and not fair, and said to me, basically, I'm going to be chair. What do you think about being vice chair? And I kind of went, what? And he said, well, you know, I'm going to suggest that you could be vice chair. And the implication being that if he suggested it, it's what would happen. Because you know how these things work. Yeah. They work, you know, groups work together with certain people, and then, you know, they all decide between themselves what's going to happen. But that is what happened, and I became the vice chair of Momentum. And as vice chair, I was extremely, I was extremely effective. I'm a good community organizer. I've got good basic organization skills. People Thank you. People like working with me because, you know, I think people have a sense when you're coming from somewhere of real creativity, real attention, real sympathy, real empathy.
And toxicity
And
too, yeah.
yes, and my work, not just political work, but my professional work, had been working with alienated audiences very often. So, with majority white working class communities on anti-racism. So, I wasn't doing anti-racism with a classroom full of university lecturers. I was doing anti-racism with bus drivers and cleaners and postmen and people like that. And I think, you know, that teaches you a lot about what's happening in people's lives, the reality of people's lives. And I think people sense that very much from me. And I think from that point, I think I became, as my independence, my effectiveness became clear, I think very early on, I was picked out as somebody who had to be destroyed politically.
Yeah, that was quite obvious, quite quickly.
Yeah.
And so they expelled
Yeah.
you with like tricks. But you see, the undemocratic way you're explaining about the forming of momentum to me is already a sign that they
Yes.
were distracting power, or I don't know how to call them, but people getting into. To do the yeah
Power.
to grab power.
Yes. And I think it's something. I mean, there's already lots of discussions going on in what is the nucleus of this new party about how that can be prevented. So while Corbyn is already speaking about we must be truly democratic, we must build up from the bottom, you know, which is all things we said in
Yeah.
Momentum. Most people who are come from those campaigns are very, very aware of what happened, of the fact that, for example, for local groups to send out any communications to their members, they had to send it through central office. Now, that not only slowed down communication, which can at times be an absolutely critical thing to do. If you need to respond to something locally, you need to respond really quickly. But it also meant that anything central control didn't like, didn't approve of, was going to be censored.
Yeah.
So I think people are already on the alert and are thinking, how can local groups keep their power, keep their initiatives, and actually work in a semi-autonomous way from central control. And people might ask, why is that important? It's really
It is.
fundamental. It's kind of politics, community politics 101. I used to try, my aim was always to try and make sure that everyone who came to a local meeting felt that their vote and their voice was crucially important. That if they didn't come to that meeting, it might change what
Absolutely.
happens. Now, if you don't do that, people won't come
Of
to the
course not.
local meetings. If they don't come to the local meetings, you cannot build from the bottom up a political force. And, you know, the right, and I include these, what are called the liberals, as the right in a way. The right have access to money. They have access to the media. We have one tool to use, and that's our solidarity and our ground-up power. And if we don't learn to utilize that in an effective way, then we're always going to
Yeah.
lose. I mean, you know, let's face it. In many ways, we are kind of bound to lose until we win. That's what this game is actually about, because they will find increasingly draconian ways. Yeah. Because, you know, the way I feel about it is that we are watching the end of capitalism. And as it becomes closer and closer to the end, capitalism will become more decadent. It will become more cruel. It will become more deceitful. It will become
violent,
more oppressive, all of those things. And actually what we're seeing in Palestine and in Israel at the moment is exactly that. We're seeing capitalism red in tooth and claw.
Yeah. And I'm 100% with you on that. The disfranchisement, I don't know, sometimes my word, sorry about my English people.
That's good.
Yeah. We can see a lot of people are not voting, are like far left, far behind the whole process. And that's what they want. So I 100% agree with you that as long as you don't pull the people in and that everyone take a share of responsibility, nothing is really threatening for the establishment, because they know only the number can surpass them. And the element of surprise you were talking earlier was also something that I found quite interesting, because I also felt the establishment was not ready for Corbyn. And like they were not ready for the Gilets Jaunes, the yellow vest in France. But the problem is that, yeah, of course, we learn from our past mistakes. And I hope, I would say, lesson will be learned. Let's talk about the lesson a little bit later. But the establishment is also learning.
Yeah. Yes.
And so this has to be taken into consideration for the next try, we'll say.
Yes.
Because they also have a lot of resources, as you said, and so they can now understand, yes, where the danger comes from, and they will smash it even stronger. So now the lesson, yes, point, what have we learned from this rise and fall of Jeremy Corbyn within the Labour Party? One to me is that if you try the revolution within a very rigid, already compromised corrupt party, there's no chance. And
yes.
And the other one is like, you need to recognize who is your ally, and when the wave are the strongest, you need to hold on and grip to one another, not throw each other under the bus, because it seems to be the best stuff to do at the time. What do you think, and yeah, what other lessons can we take from that experience?
Well, I think this, you know, what we can take from that experience, and this is what I've been, it's been very, very interesting. I do a very small sort of online political show for activists. I do a small slot on there every week. And I dropped a suggestion in there, I think it was 2 weeks ago. And it's now being repeated in all sorts of distant places. So, for example, one thing that I think we've got to do is to be much more prepared for the attacks that there'll, yeah, be on us. And we have to say not just that we're anti-racist, because saying that is just like, you know, okay, the right wing claims that they're anti-racist. Yeah. You know, Zionists, you know, Netanyahu claims that he's anti-racist, so does Trump. You know, it means nothing anymore. We have to actually say and claim and make it loud and make it proud that we're actually anti-Zionists. We have to actually do that, because otherwise you're constantly on the back foot. You're always then defending something, whereas if you go, well, actually we're anti-Zionists here, you know, and if they say, well, does that mean you're anti-Semitic, you just go, no, it's just nonsense, you know, it's just rubbish, we're anti-Zionists. And I think especially with what's happened in Gaza in particular and the West Bank recently, people's level of political awareness of this has skyrocketed. rocketed. I mean, you know, honestly, yeah. Israel has done an extraordinary job in educating the mass of the population about what is happening there. So I think we've got that we can build on. We can also, now I'm talking very much in a UK way, I realize, and maybe I can say something about, you know, the Trump thing as well. In terms of the UK, we have a Labour government and they're messing up. They're actually smashing Labour support. That gives us a huge opportunity, and we should really go out and get that and make it clear. Our purpose is to destroy the Labour Party, and we're destroying the Labour Party for a number of reasons. We should be very clear what those reasons are. And there are lots of people in the electorate who are ready and waiting for the message of the Labour Party being deeply corrupt, being a party of patronage, being a party that doesn't listen to ordinary people and that has no democracy in it. So that's all ready for us. In terms of, you know, you'll always get people on the right who support people like Trump, but there's also, again, you know, certainly in the UK, Trump is not a popular figure. And the fact that Starmer and the Labour government have now aligned themselves so much to the American project at a time when you can see where that would lead in policy issues in the future if we continue to ally ourselves in that way. So I have no doubt that what we will also say is that we will be against NATO as well. I think we're going to say those things really, really clearly. And I think the understanding that people have about why we're saying that will be much clearer now than it was.
Yes. I would differentiate a little bit. You said it's because of Israel that people get politicized. I would give that to the Palestinian resistance. And to everyone that is Palestinian or not, that is anti-Zionist, who make the work and exposed. Obviously, it's easy to see, but it has been easy to see the propaganda, the Zionist propaganda, for anyone who wanted to see for very long. But because of the power of the struggle of the Palestinian people for their freedom and the freedom of whole humanity, because obviously it's colonization. At his best, people could really see, but there's something really wrong, really, really off there, and start to enlighten themselves and becoming more conscious. So also there's such a gift. I mean, we cannot make them bear that, but the gift of the Palestinian people is like astonishing. It's gigantic. But I know they don't like, my friend over there, they don't like that I say that, because they always say, but please, we're still human, you know. We are like normal human beings. Yeah. And the both can work together. I understand that.
Yeah, and it's terrible what they have suffered. It's almost unbelievable. But on the other hand, we have to find the positive and the power in that. You know, the fact that people have got on their screens today, what has happened with those five journalists being murdered by Israel, you know, that their work, their words, their insight into what's going on has to have a purpose, both in Palestine, in Israel, and globally as well. And I think that is happening. And, you know, I mean, the courage of those people is, I just find it, I can hardly speak when I see these things. And I don't know about you, same, but I can only take a certain amount and then I can't take it. And it's not just, you know, I've actually got an American passport as well as a British passport, and my relatives live in America. And I say even in America, because that is, you know, basically the most Zionist country, I think, outside of Israel. Even in America now, people are haranguing senators and Congress people about what's happening. Even the MAGA people are saying, why? I mean, I don't know if you know this one, it's extraordinary. If you're an IDF soldier and you get injured, all of your medical care is funded by the US government.
Yeah, I'll read
now.
That.
All of your medical care. And I think there are a lot of Americans who are either doing without proper medical care or any medical care, who are outraged at that. They're just outraged at it. And I think that is something that has set a seed. And, you know, that's not going to help Palestinians now. But we have to take what we can from that situation and learn from it.
Yes.
And fight back about it.
Maybe we'll come back on America after. I see two line of attack for your party, the new party that is riding at the moment. And maybe some people don't know here, but there were 700,000 people subscribing to you. It's called now Your Party, and it's, maybe they will change the name. We'll see. Like show their willingness to try something else, to get empowered again. Through something that has to become. And I think two lines of attack that are going to come very quickly is obviously the anti-Semitism attack, because it worked so well. But I'm not sure it's going to work that well anymore, because, you know, when you cry wolf forever, then at one point something is happening. That's what I said to my kids, and this is very understandable. The other one is like in USA, because you have a two-party system, so they're going to attack you and say, in voting for your party, you're going to actually put reform on power, because you're actually help. It's like, you know, if you vote for Trump, then if you don't vote for Kamala Harris, then you're going to put Trump. It's your fault. So this is the attack that is going to come. And I'm 100% sure that will be the two first line of attack.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, that is such a pathetic response coming from a party who, and I won't go into the finer detail of this, but who have attacked the welfare state. You know, they have shoved our, you know, the working classes, the middle classes into the arms of the right wing by the policies they have taken, by the fiscal policies that they have taken, their refusal to tax the rich, their cutting of public services, their grandstanding on migration control, their racist stance, not just against Palestinians, you know, but against all minorities, has actually helped bolster up the right here. I'll take no lectures from these people. If anybody has built reform, you know, the Labour Party, like I said to you, we did this wonderful campaign to keep Farage out, that's the right winger, out of Parliament the last time. We did this great, very effective campaign. In fact, it was hilarious, because it was basically a group of about 30 or 40 menopausal women who ran this campaign. We were so effective. We were so creative. We made fun of them. And that attracted not just local, but national and international attention. So we were able to think of those kind of creative ways. But what happened in this last election, when Nigel Farage from the Reform Party, the leader of the Reform Party, got in, was that he decided very late in the day that he would stand for a seat, which was very similar to the one that we stopped him getting into. So it was very white, very poor, seaside town that was, you know, economically just going down, 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 and very sad in many ways place. And the Labour Party put a candidate in there, and then when Farage decided he would run there, they withdrew funding basically from that candidate, yeah, and all support from him. So basically they gave Farage an open door to go into that constituency and decided not to fight it. So I'm not going to take any lectures from any Labour Party people telling me about my... One of my purposes in the next election, let me be clear on this, is to smash the Labour Party. And if it's so broken that it never, never gets into power again, I will be very happy with that at the end of the election.
Don't we forget that the Labour Party is also Tony Blair and illegal war around the world, killing thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of, exactly, of thousands of innocent people in Iraq, exactly, and everywhere else.
And he's also been already, the Tony Blair Foundation, has been having talks with the Netanyahu regime about how they're going to develop Gaza for, you know, it's like seeing these, you know, that old cartoon, I don't know if you've seen it, where there's a group of extremely corpulent capitalists around the table and they're carving, yeah, up, they're kind of carving up the world, yeah, between them, and they're just stuffing,
and they
their
give you
faces,
the crumbles.
Yeah, well, that's he's already done that with Netanyahu. I mean, these people have got nothing to tell me about.
Absolutely,
this.
You, I'm sure, but the work would have to educate also the new members of the new party, because I think, yeah, also a big way of manipulation that the establishment has, and we could see it worked during 2016, is that the media could make the people believe that Jeremy Corbyn was a rabid racist. I mean, the guy was. His life is about like anti-racism, but people, I suppose, were thinking he actually was a racist because they could like use the propaganda at work. So also the information and media system has to be organized and understood by the activists and the new members.
You know, that's true and it's not true at the same time. The way it's not true is that we mustn't forget how close we came to winning the last election. People have been fed this lie that, you know, we lost a disaster. Look at,
yeah,
the
there
votes.
Were more vote than we Starmer.
One of the biggest Labour post-war votes. It was how, so, you know, we've got to be very careful about. So even though that was going on at the time, you know, that result was astonishing. Now, of course, they're going to throw all that around, yeah, and, you know, of course, that's going to happen. But there is a very different population now, and our media is far more diverse. People, the trust in the BBC and the other major purveyors of establishment news, especially our newspapers in the UK, which are evidentially, you know, there's been research done on this, the most right wing in Europe, but fewer and fewer people are reading them. And most people now are not getting their news from the BBC. So I think we're in a different ball game here. And I think, just like you say about calling Wolf too many times, you know, I just don't think it's going to work this time. I just don't. I just don't think it's going to be effective. It'll only be effective with people who are avowedly the enemies of the right, and they will be talking to their own constituency, but I don't think other people will believe it very much. I really don't.
Not this time. But alternative media has to play a role also. And
that's
problematic because we, like... who can we trust? Because last time also there were Novara Media or Owen Jones, which are a figure that somehow I feel I need to listen to, but I could see there were some breaks, and that they at the very first opportunity threw you under the bus the same way. And so that's also a lesson that is,
it's problematic. Yeah. They are very problematic. Now, interestingly, you know, I could recount the old stories about how they jumped on that anti-Semitism witch hunt bandwagon. So you had Aaron Bastani going on you know, prime time TV,
I was blowing him, yeah.
talking about how there was a major problem with anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, which was absolute nonsense. There wasn't a major problem.
There were even a report, I don't know the name of the report, that was showing that there were no more problem in the left with the anti-Semitism that they
exactly.
were.
Every report yeah. has shown that. Then you had Ash Sarkar doing things like, you know, calling me, what did she call me? A crank, which is an abusive term, basically. They've never really taken that back. But and Owen Jones, in a way, I think he was even worse in a way, because he flip-flopped yeah. so much. And he actually appeared on the platform of the Zionist Jewish Labour movement. And at that point, kind of disowned a number of people, including me. So you've yeah. got that. But even more recently, and I know this, it might be hard for me to describe, Aaron Bastani showed this clip of this black guy who was obviously having a mental breakdown, and he had taken off his clothes in the on public transport and was shouting and screaming. And then the other passengers
yeah, I saw that.
Were
Indeed,
getting
yeah.
and beating him up.
Yeah.
And Aaron Bastani's comment was, you know, wow, I mean, this shows you why we need more police, right? Whereas people like me, a number of people who were mental health experts, said, this guy is obviously having a mental health breakdown, and you are joining in with the racists talking about this black person needing to be restrained by police. You know, I don't know what makes these, I mean, you know, people like Aaron Bastani, I don't know why they keep on making these mistakes. We all make mistakes. But it's the kind of mistake that's made repeatedly that concerns me, because I don't think they have fundamentally really learned from it. And until they address that, you know, of course, Owen Jones has done some brilliant reporting about Palestine. He's done some, I mean, you know, and Novara Media have done some good reporting. But you just have to be really careful with these guys. And they take up that space. They are the acceptable face of the left in British broadcasting. They will have people from Novara Media on where they won't, well, I used to get on, but they won't have people like me, for example, on. But, and this is the important thing to know, Novara Media won't have people like me on. Hmm. Yeah. So, you know, as long as this goes on, I think we have to be careful, but there are other sources, and of course, people have their own little mobile phones. And you know, I'm not saying regularly, but you know, I have a reasonable following on Twitter. I do the odd little thing, and it gets out to tens of thousands.
More direct
sometimes
now.
Mm-hmm. Even. Yeah, yeah. So there is more space.
It is. But I think some reckoning are necessary, and I don't know how you're going to organize that, but I think any new party or new, I don't know, organization needs to build up their own media also. They need to own the information. So as you said earlier, they are not on the back foot being needed to answer all the time, the attack and answer, and lose all of your time just answering to show that you are an honest person and you are not basically a criminal. You need to, you know, so that's also something that we could see in France was not in place and who could also cost a lot of trouble to newcomers and so that I have to say that you were thrown under the bus and expelled, but you were not the only one, and Jews were particularly targeted. I have the name of Joe Bird, Ken Livingston, Tony Greenstein, Lech Levane, Naomi Winborn, Chris Williamson.
Jews were something like 50% or something like that more likely to be expelled from the Labour Party than any other group. I mean, all this thing about anti-Semitism, because what they couldn't take was Jews speaking out against this sham accusations of anti-Semitism. And they came down heavier on Jewish people than anybody else.
And that's a sign, isn't it? Sometimes I'm very surprised why we would follow a Trump or a Nigel Farage, which I can kind of understand people desperate, but that doesn't take the time to really think that through, say, and accept the, you know, the obvious bullshit. For anyone who takes a little bit of its time to observe and understand, to me, one good prospect to go and look for is that how, with what power, how fearful are the establishment against the people, and the one who are actually taking the more heat, the strongest heat. Then here you have it. There's someone who is serious, you know.
I mean, I did, you know, I always say to people, when an organization, a major organization, and I had two organizations, one in America and another one in the UK that are supposedly reputable for, you know, far right stroke Zionist organizations, quoting me as being the number two threat to Jews in the world, then you know that there's something wrong. You know, I mean, really, I'm the number two threat to Jews in the whole world. And these preposterous claims, they just have to be laughed at. They really have to, you just have to laugh. It's just nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, because if you start entering the game of, you know, justifying it and say, oh, but, then you're losing. And we could see that with Trump, because all the media was against him, but he gave him airtime and face recognition. So basically, you only had Trump everywhere. So when you have to put the cross, you're like, oh, what is in your head, Trump? I don't know. It's like, it's madness, to be honest.
But the electorate are looking for what they perceive of as fearless, direct dialogue, right? They, you know, Starmer is very good at saying nothing but using a lot of words. And the electorate are sick and tired of it. And we just need to talk directly and call nonsense nonsense and just say, oh, this is garbage, you know. It's just garbage. And when it's garbage.
That's what Farage and Trump are doing. And that's why people are like, oh, people are saying, but they think, oh my God, it's so rare. Let's vote for them.
Yeah.
Well, it's not exactly enough. You also are a one-woman show, an artist, we can say, and you created a show after all this story, The Lynching, because you also linked what happened to the slavery. And I think there's like a line here that we can also try to pull a little bit.
Okay, so one of the other things that I did, when people are being horrible to me, I had this very funny thing with this left-wing guy when I was talking to them, and he said something, and I mentioned some experience I had in the area, and he looked at me and he said, have you just done everything in the whole world? And I said to him, that's a really interesting thing you said, because you would never say that to a white man, would you? But it just happens that one of the things that I have done is postgraduate studies in drama, and I've also worked in the theatre. So when the witch hunt happened to me, and remember, although I was in the media a lot, just because you're in the media a lot doesn't mean your message gets over, because what they were doing was editing me. They were editorializing me, and they were literally lying about me. And you have no one to go to. I mean, this farce that there's anything like a press committee, or that people like me can take these giant media organizations to the law if they say something that is untrue, is absolute garbage. That's just not how it works. So I decided, which just seems mad now, really, doesn't it, that I would write, because I'm also a writer, that I would, you know, write a one-woman show, and I would take it to a festival called the Edinburgh Festival, which is quite well known. And it went well. We started to get people asking for it to be done in their area. And it ended up being not just going on nationwide, and I mean in all three countries of the United Kingdom. I also did it in America as well. And what I did is that I kind of used a bit the narrative that I had built up from my kind of semi-autobiographical family memoir, which linked the history, my history of enslavement and oppression and racism, and the experience of being an oppressed Jewish people, with McCarthyism in America. If you remember, I said that my mother was deported from the US for un-American activities. And so I played my mother. I also, for my sins, sang. But I also, it was about, I don't know, probably about an hour and 10 minutes of a one-woman show, which kind of seems crazy now. It really does. I don't even know how I did it now. I don't think I could do it again. It took a lot of energy. It took a lot of energy to do it. But it was kind of, it was successful enough that one of our primary comedians in the UK, political comedians, who's also Jewish, a guy called Alexei Sale, he has access to writing up in The Guardian, those kind of national newspapers. And he was asked the 10 things that he thought you shouldn't miss if you were in London to see. And he put my show in it. I didn't even know when he came to see it. I didn't even realize he'd come to see it. But, you know, it was the kind of thing where getting that kind of exposure should have really got you everywhere on the media and on that kind of, you know, wow, black woman develops rights and performs her own show, blah, blah, blah. Whereas actually it was all very underground. Oh, I did it in, I did do it in Berlin. I had the most amazing show in Berlin, which was sponsored by a group of Jewish anarchists in Berlin, because, you know, Berlin has one of the highest populations of Israelis there. And they put on this show, and it was in this ex-warehouse, and it literally had people sitting on the windowsills. It was the most amazing experience to do it there and to do it for that audience as well. So it kind of became a bit of a sort of underground thing as well.
Sure, because the repression is getting stronger and stronger. And if there is one thing we also need to be wary of is the repression. I mean, we've seen lately what happened in Berlin as well. in Germany. What happened to the protest? The one who protests the Gaza genocide. They got like beaten and all the like extremely violently.
They're beating up Jewish people, in Berlin for objecting to genocides. I mean, you couldn't honestly, you couldn't write that, could you? Nobody would have believed you saying that. But the German anti-Zionists, Jews, are totally, I mean, they're really hardcore. Yeah. They're very, very courageous people because they have already come from Israel, where they have had to put up and resist so hard to just keep their position. So even in Germany, you know, what I'm saying is that they've gone through that experience of being a silenced minority who are kind of despised and treated badly by the state. So I have such admiration for those Jews in Berlin who do this. They're just extraordinary people. They really are extraordinary.
And they also know that that's the bad name for Jewishness in general. What Israel is doing is also purposefully also trying to link Israeli with Jewishness. They have been doing that for years.
It's an outrage what they're doing, and it makes really, really dangerous.
It's extremely dangerous because the day the table turns and we have fascist governments again, which is a big chance when you see USA and Austria and Germany, and there's a big chance of that. So I think they also understood the possibility of the stick that will come back to their face. And
the thing about Zionism, though, it's never cared about Jewish life. You know, it's as I'm sure you know, the Zionists made deals with Hitler in order to get their people out, and they did that at the cost of many other Jews. The Zionists have never had as their primary focus, I would suggest, the welfare and preservation of the Jewish people as a whole. What they have as their priority is the development and the sustenance of their vision of what Jewishness should be. And I have to tell you, if you come outside of that, the savageness with which you're attacked, not just, you know, outside of the Jewish community, but within the Jewish community, is extraordinary. But even with that, you just look at the figures of what's happening with young Jews in America. You know, young Jews are turning away from this, and they're turning away from it for very, very good reasons. I mean, I think Zionism is also dead. It just doesn't know it yet. I mean, I mean, how that leaves the Palestinian people at this point, I have no idea. But what I know is that the project of Zionism being looked at as a project that preserves the lives and welfare of a community that has known a genocide, I think that's broken in people's minds forever. I think that one's not, you know, they can, it's, I mean, in England, we have the establishment of a new Holocaust Museum, which is being paid for by the government and being built on a piece of land where nobody in the community wants it to be built. You'll still get the executive doing stuff like that, you know, almost the kind of enforced practice of the acknowledgement of Zionism. You'll get Trump saying that he will withdraw money from states who don't conform to BDS. You'll get that for a bit, but the tide is turning with the electorate. They're not going to take this for much longer. They really aren't.
There is there was this description, explanation of ARA definition of antisemitism, which is also a problem because they in order to carry their project, Zionist project, they had to also silence the critique of Israel and to mix the two.
Yeah.
And in Switzerland, we adopted the EHRA definition, but it's not really linked to any law. It says that the authority can use it, but it's not officially laws. So we had to say yes, but we have some distances. And I know at the time that in UK, there was also a factor of purging the Labour Party because people were seeing the corruption behind the move. And what is it like as for today? Is like someone who is actually trying to make an anti-Zionist point can be arrested. We've seen lately, obviously, the Palestine Action has been declared as a terrorist organization. So by law, if you support them, then... Mm-hmm. But what is it about this definition? Is it like
well, something? I think the state is working in a very different way on different levels. So of course you have what's happening with Palestine Action. I'm laughing because you know you're getting 89-year-old women being arrested for terrorist offences. Mm-hmm. You're getting this weekend there was a blind man of some years in a wheelchair who was arrested. You know, I mean, this stuff is going all around and looking absolutely absurd. But what I think where it is having an effect is in the general chilling of speech. And just like in the US, though not to the same extent, I think it's also happening within the university sectors and the education sectors. I think it's happening in the health sectors where, for example, a number of medical staff have been sacked from their posts within particularly teaching hospitals for wearing little Palestinian badges and refusing to take them off. I mean, you know, I think you should you either have a policy where you say no insignia, and that includes Ukraine, for example, or you have to have a reason. And their reason that they use is the IHRA. So it's working on lots and lots of different levels. And the way it works is to make people terrified of speaking up for Palestine. It works in that way. And also, for example, but you see, there are resistances. So we have a big retail organization here called the Co-op. And the Co-op members have all voted to disinvest and acknowledge BDS in all purchasing. So things are moving. It's all very active at the moment. It's all contested, and that's keeping everybody very busy on this. And they use the IHRA just like they use the ridiculous terrorist legislation as a way to control or attempt to control and to silence. They're not doing a very good job now because the words Palestine Action are now being repeated regularly on the TV, on the radio.
What media do you follow? I like Unclassified in UK. It's very interesting.
Yeah, of course.
And I used to read the blog, the Squawk Box.
Yes.
Yeah, that was nice.
Squawk. I also have a look at Al Jazeera. I look at Mehdi Hassan and see what, you know, he's an English person, but he's broadcasting now from America. He has his own kind of platform in America. I like to keep a bit abreast with what's happening in America because I think it's, you know, we are, after all, only a satellite of the American imperial system. So you need to know what your boss is saying. You know, so I certainly do that. And then I go online and I listen to people, and I listen to people who I think know a lot more about whatever it is I want to talk about. I also, and somebody said, actually my partner said to me recently, I was listening to this Zionist, I won't even bother referring to who it was, and he said to me, "How can you listen to that rubbish?" He said, "I can't bear it." And I said, "You need to hear what your enemy is saying. You need to keep in touch with what your enemy is doing and what they're saying." So I try and make sure that I do those things as much as I
That
can.
was the best teaching of Nelson Mandela, by the way, to keep in touch with your enemy. That's what he did. If you read this book, The Long Walk to Freedom, he explained that
Well,
very well.
I didn't read it. I just got it out of my own head.
You have Mandela spirit, I have no doubt about that. So maybe we can finish this fascinating and crucial conversation with Palestine, because I think that's where every thought and every energy should be used. And you were talking about these five journalists earlier. That's Anas Al-Sharif, that's Mohammed Greikai, Ibrahim Saheya, Mohammed Nufal, and Mohammed Aliwa. And they were working for Al Jazeera, the five of them, and they were targeted on purpose by Israel, who acknowledged it today this morning, because they said that he was the responsible.
They gloried in it. They didn't just, they
Yeah, they
boasted
boasted about
about
it.
it. They did a red strip and said eliminated, like it's some kind of computer
And they said
game.
because he was a boss of a cell, a terrorist cell, obviously. So now they don't even bother to dismiss. So that's incredible. And they think they can get away with it. I think that's the problem. You know, they for so long they could do whatever with no consequences, with no punishment and everything. So now why bother? You know, you just go and flat everything. Sometimes I don't even know why they lie, because they could say, well, you know, we are the chosen people, so we can kill whatever and fuck you.
Well, they do say that sometimes, but when they say that, we're told, oh, that's just the far right of the government. You know, it just happens to be the defense secretary or, you know, the equalities minister saying stuff like that. And we're told, you know, but at ministerial level, they do say that. It's
They do.
Netanyahu who
Yeah.
lies. The rest of them lie. They're telling it
Yeah.
as it is,
The
pretty.
last one, the last line is that it's not Israel who destroy everything in Gaza, but it was actually the booby trap. So we had to explode the house because, you know, Hamas booby trap.
But can you
No.
imagine how explosive Hamas would have
You don't
needed
even
to
need to try
have?
to imagine.
It's like, are we
Apparently,
stupid?
there's a lot of stupid people, I guess, but probably less than we think. And I hope revolution will come. But you know, I have a grief against the media. I started this media in 2019, also because I could not find a really relevant information within the normal press. And I had to like do like deep research to actually get to know anything. And as for today, I mean, that's the number, but probably higher. There's 269 journalists who were massacred these last 2 years, and they supposed journalist colleagues are saying jack shit. This is incredible. I think there's more journalists killed than the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnamese War, and Iraq War, and Afghanistan War combined. And we're sitting there thinking, who is the worst? Hamas? Or who? And this is so obvious, my God. And this is really depressing, to be honest.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I have absolutely no idea what the immediate future holds for those people suffering in Gaza. Yeah. And I sometimes say, when I'm with my family, you know, if I was there and I was with my kids and my grandkids, I mean, how would you not want to leave? I don't know how you would not want to leave, because they are in suffering, real suffering, every single day, every single day. And it is unimaginable what is happening to
them. It's unspeakable, yeah.
But it is, I have no trust in our leaders. I have no trust in the ability of our institutions to make a difference. And that is going to be a real problem in the future, I also think. But I suppose what I do have, even it may be that I force myself to do this, I force myself to have optimism about the human spirit and the human history of struggle. And you know, when I'm going to get this as a paraphrase wrong, but basically you probably know this one, where Chairman Mao was asked about the significance of the French Revolution. And he said, it's too early to tell. Right? Yeah. And I think one of the problems for us, whenever we are going through moments of acute and painful struggle, is it's always too early to tell.
Yeah.
And you know, we have very little insight as to how things will come out in the end. But I have a strong sense that we are seeing the death throes of not just capitalism, but of American imperialism. The two go in the same way. It's obvious to me that that is happening. And that holds out some hope for me.
Also for me, I noticed because I went to walk to the Global March to Gaza in Cairo, that when I'm involved and active in the Palestinian struggle, but there will also be the Congolese struggle, other atrocities around the world. I mean, there's no shortage of it, I felt like, In some ways, I was saving my own humanity personally, individually. When doing that, I had this feeling of alignment, of pride to work for something that was bigger than me. And so that's why also today I feel like one thing that we can do is just give space to their enlightenments. And if you're okay, I'd like to read the Anas al-Sharif last messages.
Please.
This is my will and my final message. If this word reach you, know that Israel has succeeded in killing me and silencing my voice. First, peace be upon you and Allah, mercy and blessing. Allah knows I gave every effort on all my strengths to be a support and a voice for my people. Ever since I opened my eyes to life in these alleys and streets of the Jabalia refugee camp, my hope was that Allah would extend my life so I could return with my family and loved ones to our original town of occupied Aswanan. But Allah's will came first, and his decree is final. I have lived through pain in all its detail, tasted suffering and loss many times, yet I never once hesitated to convey the truth as it is, without distortion or falsification, so that Allah may bear witness against those who stayed silent, those who accepted our killings, those who choked our breath, and whose hearts were unmoved by the scattered remains of our children and women, doing nothing to stop the massacre that our people have faced for more than a year and a half. I entrust you with Palestine, the jewel in the crown of the Muslim world, the heartbeat of every free person in this world. I entrust you with its people, with its wronged and innocent children who never had the time to dream or live in safety and peace. Their pure bodies were crushed under thousands of tons of Israel bombs and missiles, torn apart and scattered across the walls. I urge you not to let chains silence you, nor borders restrain you. Be bridges toward the liberation of the land and its people, until the sun of dignity and freedom rises over our stolen homeland. I entrust you to take care of my family. I entrust you with my beloved daughter Sham, the light of my eyes, whom I never got the chance to watch grow up as I had dreamed. I entrust you with my dear son Salah, whom I had wished to support and accompany through life until he grew strong enough to carry my burden and continue the mission. I entrust you with my beloved mother, whose blessed prayers brought me to where I am, whose supplication were my fortress, and whose light guided my path. I pray that Allah grants her strength and rewards her on my behalf with the best of rewards. I also entrust my wife, my lifelong companion, my beloved wife, Salah, from whom the war separated me for many long days and months. Yet she remained faithful to our bond, steadfast as the trunk of an olive tree that does not bend, patient, trusting in Allah, and carrying the responsibility in my absence with all her strength and faith. I urge you to stand by them, to be their support after Allah Almighty. If I die, I die steadfast upon my principle. I testify before Allah that I am content with his decree, certain of meeting him, and assured that what is with Allah is better and everlasting. Allah, accept me among the martyrs, forgive my past and future sin, and make my blood a light that illuminates the path of freedom for my people and my family. Forgive me if I have fallen short, and pray for me with mercy, for I kept my promise and never changed or betrayed it. Do not forget Gaza, and do not forget me in your sincere prayers for forgiveness and acceptance. Anas Jamal al-Sharif, received today. Here we go. And yeah, that's the legacy that and I feel like I want to carry also my path and follow as much as I can.
As much as we can.
Mm.
Which is what all we can do.
It is. They are showing the path to me. It's quite clear.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Jackie Walker, for your struggle. Also, the path you're showing in UK and for the world. That's so big that I cannot find the words. We need more people like you, and I hope maybe when the worst happening, that's also where the most beautiful light, like this man Anas al-Sharif just showed, that's where the most beautiful light are actually able to show the world how beautiful they are.
Well, I'm sort of a bit choked, actually. I can't really speak much more. I find it too disturbing. The courage of these people is just, it just puts everything else in a shade, really.
Yeah, and they should not carry that by themselves.
Yeah.
So your party is maybe one part of the answer. You're living also, and you still will work toward that. Let us know if anything, anything like worst of revolution is to be found.
Yeah, well, keep in contact. We can talk more.
Yeah, I wish we could do that. That would be, I think, necessary. I also have, it's hard for me now to find the words.
Yeah.
So we're going to left it at that. Thank you so very much. Thanks. Again, because also for your patience and to putting up with me, because I did this mistake and last time we could redo it. So thank you very much for
thank you.
See you next time.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Wait. Yeah. That was okay. This time everything recorded. I'm stopping the recording.
Yes.
All right.